I do not have any relationship to disclose either, so I think we're off to a good start. I will be taking you through a number of topics during this presentation, emphasizing what is new in terms of fish and the dietary guidelines for Americans, how we reached the conclusions that we did, and which are the recommendations that we are making regarding seafood intake for different groups in the population. And finally, as Larry did, I will try to come up with some reflections as to some public health approaches that we can use to help meet the dietary guideline goals related to seafood. So to begin with, the term seafood oftentimes causes some confusion because it means different things to different people. So this is the definition that we used, the Dietary Guidelines Committee used, mostly based on the same definition that the Institute of Medicine used when they did the committee recommendations entitled Seafood Choices. So seafood is a large category of marine animals that live in the sea and fresh water bodies like lakes and rivers. Seafood examples are a relationship to fish. We'll be talking a lot about salmon today, tuna, and so on. But we know that shellfish is also an important source for some populations of seafood, including shrimp, crab, and oysters. So, what can I tell you about the focus of the 2010 Dietary Guidelines for Americans with regarding seafood? Well, first and foremost, the committee concluded after reviewing a whole body of past and current evidence that the topic is of such importance that seafood is in fact now the first food listed under animal protein food sources and also plant-based protein sources. And not only is it the first food listed under protein sources in the guidelines, but it is also featured in the cover of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans, the policy report, and if you look at the consumer report, one of the four key recommendations is to build a healthy plate, and the picture that depicts the healthy plate also shows a very appetizing slice of salmon. So I think that at the end of the day, the government put a lot of attention to the recommendation from the scientific committee, and they really thought it was important to now highlight the importance of seafood consumption as part of the American diet. In terms of the evidence that we discussed at length as part of the deliberations of the committee was related to the fact that there are lots of benefits that can be obtained, for example, through the omega-3 fatty acids in food related to improved development of neurological development of the fetuses and young children, and also in relationship to the protective impact that it can have on coronary heart disease. On the other hand, we also obviously reviewed the evidence that I'm going to briefly share with you today about the risks involved with the consumption of seafood, mostly as a result of exposure to methylmercury, which has also an impact on the same outcomes, but in the opposite direction. So it is a true benefit-risk analysis, the one that had to be done. This time, the Dietary Guidelines for Americans not only emphasized specific nutrients or food groups, but also tried to emphasize a lot specific foods that we thought they were heavily underconsumed by the American population and needed to be increased. And under the list of foods that need to be increased, it is listed very clearly and involved the topic of seafood. So what are the key recommendations that we now have reflected in the dietary guidelines? Well, first of all, it is to increase the amount and variety of seafood consumed by choosing more seafood in place of some meat and poultry. Obviously, the recommendation is not to completely replace meat and poultry, but to replace some of the protein that is coming from meat and poultry, and to consume 8 ounces or more of seafood per week, and proportionally less for young children according to their energy and protein needs. We now estimate or recommend that about 20% of the intake of protein foods should be derived from a variety of seafood. And we want to emphasize the word variety because, as it happens with produce, fruits and vegetables and so on, we do have a rainbow of colors and types of fish based on their macronutrient composition out there. And we want to make sure that, you know, people are exposed as much as possible to the different benefits that different species offer, and also to minimize their exposure to contaminants that also different species offer. So if we think about the topic of replacing different foods, we want to replace foods that are higher in solid fats with choices that are lower in solid fats and higher in oils. And in terms of the composition of seafood, especially the more oily the fish is, the more it falls within this category, we ended up concluding that really seafood belongs to the category of oils and not of solid fats. So in terms of the lipid composition of fish, we found it to have a very favorable profile. Seafood is a very important source of omega-3 fatty acids, especially EPA and DHA, but that's not the only nutritional benefit that it offers. It is also an important source of heme iron. And as I mentioned before, it does have a protective effect against cardiovascular disease. So the trick here is to try to maximize the consumption of seafood that is high in omega-3 fatty acids, at the same time to try to minimize the exposure to methylmercury. So you can see that to begin with, this already is illustrating the major public health challenge that we have, because the consumer requires a lot of information to be able to identify which seafood species have a high content of omega-3 fatty acids and a relatively low content of methylmercury and perhaps other contaminants. So methylmercury, unfortunately, is a compound that we're probably never going to be able to get completely rid of, because about half of the deposition of mercury that happens in the waters is man-made, but about the other half is the result of volcanic emissions. So there is quite a good amount of mercury that ends up in our waters as a result of natural events. Once the mercury hits the water, then we have microorganisms that methylate the mercury, and as a result, we now have the methylmercury compound. The way the food chain works, the more we move up the food chain in terms of the seafood species, the more the methylmercury is going to be accumulated in the lean tissue, in the muscle, not in the fatty tissue, but in the muscle, in the lean tissue of fish. So as a result, the seafood, the fish that has the highest concentration of methylmercury, are large predatory fish such as sharks, swordfish, tilefish, and king mackerel, that fortunately they are not heavily consumed in the U.S. And definitely those are for species that we don't want pregnant women, for example, to be exposed to. Now, the issue as to what are the negative consequences, what is the risk that methylmercury poses for human health, it's a very interesting one, and it is not totally clear. We know from the Minamata Bay tragedy that happened in Japan in the 1950s that a good number of fetuses, adults, the population at large consuming seafood from that bay were exposed to massive amounts of methylmercury as a result of the leak of mercury from a chemical plant. And what it became very clear is that that acute large exposure to mercury had a very devastating negative effect on the brain development of the fetuses, although it did not have the same type of negative obvious impact on the brains of adults. So based on that incident, it became very clear that the exposure to mercury during pregnancy, the fetal exposure, could potentially cause serious issues related to the neurological development of the fetus. But the question that really we need to answer is whether chronic exposure to relatively lower amounts of methylmercury has negative consequences for the neurological development of fetuses and young children. And there are three big studies that have been conducted that have provided a lot of the data upon which the recommendations from the US and other countries have been based. These are studies that were conducted in New Zealand, in the Faroe Islands in the North Atlantic, and in the Seychelles in the Indian Ocean. And looking at statistical significance, both the studies from New Zealand and the Faroe Islands suggested that there was a negative impact of higher levels of mercury in the hair of moms on the neurological development of the fetuses or young children. However, in the Seychelles study, the relationships were not statistically significant. So for many years, there has been a very strong debate among these researchers on whether exposure on a chronic basis to relatively low levels of methylmercury has a negative impact on the neurological development of children. What the IOM committee did in 2007 when they were looking at the seafood choices, as they entitled their report, was to actually just base the conclusions using effect size estimations and not paying so much attention to the p-values. When they did that, there was pretty much very good agreement among the three studies that indeed, after a certain threshold, it was likely that exposure to mercury would harm, during pregnancy, would harm the neurological development of the child. So data from these studies was very instrumental for the EPA-FDA advisory that was released in 2004, especially recommending for pregnant women to not consume more than 20 ounces of seafood per week, and to pay a lot of attention to the methylmercury content and not eat certain types of large predatory fish and albacore tuna and so on, and to make sure that the women paid a lot of attention to the local advisories related to freshwater seafood to make sure that they would not expose their fetuses to unreasonable risks. There has been the hypothesis and a little bit of support for perhaps a relationship between methylmercury exposure and an increased risk of coronary heart disease, although that evidence is quite inconsistent and is not clear at all. So the advisories have mostly been driven by the potential relationship of the chronic exposure to methylmercury on the neurological development of children. So the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee concluded that there was moderate evidence to show that consumption of 2 servings of seafood per week, about 8 ounces per week, could provide an average of 250 milligrams per day of omega-3 fatty acids. And these 250 milligrams per day of omega-3 fatty acids became a very important number for us, because I will show you in a minute the data suggesting that that is a very reasonable target to have when it comes to the protection against the risk of coronary heart disease deaths. We evaluated a good number of studies through the NEL system to be able to reach this conclusion in a very systematic way. So that's where that 8 ounces recommendation comes from now. These are data that was derived from the paper by Mosafarian and Rim. You can see that absolute coronary heart disease mortality rates vary more than 100-fold across different populations due to differences on age, prior coronary heart disease history, and other risk factors. But the relative effects are consistent for primary or secondary prevention and across absolute risk levels. So compared with little or no fish intake, a consumption of around 250 to 500 milligrams per day of DHA is associated with lower risk of coronary heart disease. And when they did a pooled analysis of the prospective studies and randomized trials, they concluded that it was indeed at around 250 milligrams per day of omega-3 fatty acids that we could find the maximum protection against coronary heart disease, and that perhaps there is no additional benefit in terms of coronary heart disease mortality beyond that level of intake. So another question that we had, the committee concluded that there was consistent evidence showing that the health benefits derived from the consumption of a variety of cooked seafood in the U.S. in the amounts we were recommending outweighed the risk associated with methylmercury and persistent organic pollutant exposure. We did look a little bit at POP exposure. There isn't as much data out there as it is for methylmercury, but we felt that based on the level of oversight that is available right now, the data that comes from those analyses, that overall the population in the U.S. would be safe in terms of that level of exposure to POPs if they follow the recommendations made in the dietary guidelines. So this applies even among women who may become or who are pregnant, nursing mothers, and children ages 12 and younger. So which are some of the best seafood sources that we recommend? Well, as you can see, salmon is an excellent seafood source because it is relatively high in omega-3 fatty acids and relatively low in methylmercury. And we know that this applies to both farmed and wild salmon. There has been some concern about higher POPs exposure through farm salmon, because perhaps the food that is given to the farm salmon may have more contamination with POPs, but overall both farmed and wild salmon came out as very reasonable options for the U.S. population. And we have the other list in the rest of the list in front of you that you can read. We did our best to try to identify very specific fish species, the types of seafood that people could choose comfortably to obtain the benefits that it provides. And this graph summarizes the DHA content as well as the methylmercury content of different species of seafood, and that's where you can see that pilefish, swordfish, shark, etc. have very high levels of methylmercury. That when it comes to tuna, not all tuna was created alike. Albacore tuna, white tuna, has higher levels of methylmercury than light canned tuna. So with regards to the recommendations for women who are pregnant or breastfeeding, I know my time is limited, but I just want to explain that we did recommend 8 to 12 ounces, not just up to 8 ounces, because there is some evidence that we reviewed suggesting that when it comes to the neurological development of the child, the benefit continues to increase the higher the level of omega-3 fatty acid intake. So we didn't find a similar plateau or a similar threshold as we found in the case of cardiovascular disease. And we reviewed data from different countries that have different levels of seafood intake, and we felt very comfortable with this recommendation. We also had to answer a very interesting question related to omega-3 fatty acids from seafood and whether these omega-3 fatty acids then end up being transferred to the baby through breast milk. The conclusion is that there is moderate evidence indicating that increased maternal dietary intake of DHA during pregnancy and lactation is associated with increased levels in breast milk, and this in turn translates into improved infant health outcomes that reflect more appropriate neurological development, including visual acuity and cognitive development. So these are, again, the large predatory fish that we do not want pregnant women to consume. There may be some subpopulations, that this is where it becomes very important to understand the dietary habits of different groups of immigrants in the country to try to understand whether this is an issue. Of course, the WIC program is a very good program to help us spread the word related to these messages. And when it comes to white tuna or albacore tuna, it is important that pregnant women don't consume more than 6 ounces per week of it, because it tends to have relatively higher levels of methylmercury. We are comfortable calling for an increase in the consumption of seafood through every possible means that we have, because seafood is very seriously, very heavily underconsumed. We meet less than half of the goal when it comes to the recommendation. We are not a society, as a country, we don't consume a large variety of seafood. We don't consume seafood in very healthy ways. A lot of this comes from fried fish, fish and chips, fried oysters, and all those wonderful meals. I'm going to make all of you guys feel hungry. But the idea here is a larger variety cooked in ways that don't contribute in a disproportionate way to calories, and that we end up getting the benefit from the omega-3 fatty acids without lowering that benefit because of the way we prepare the meals. As you can see, the usual intake of seafood in the U.S. is quite low. There are other countries like Spain where the intake is much, much higher. The DASH diet, the USDA food pattern diet, calls for substantially higher levels of intake that could lead people to consume around 8 ounces of seafood per week, those with a 2,000 calorie level requirement. So the end of my presentation then is perhaps the part that is of most interest to the American Public Health Association, which is if we agree with the scientific review that the committee did and the endorsement of our recommendations by the federal government through the 2010 Dietary Guidelines for Americans, then how do we go about addressing some very difficult issues? As a result of the 2004 EPA-FDA advisory, what ended up happening, as documented by Emily Oaken and her group, is that fish consumption among pregnant women dropped down quite a bit. That advisory, the intention was never to send a message to OBGYNs to tell pregnant moms that they should not eat any fish at all during pregnancy. But unfortunately, that's what started happening quite a bit. There was a lot of confusion. There was fear instilled as a result of the way the media covered the advisory. So there is a need to repair a lot of this damage. And I think we have to do much better research on the area of risk-benefit communication. This is a classical risk-benefit situation where we want to communicate in a reasonable way and provide a reasonable tool for the consumer to be able to assess by themselves and when necessary with their physicians what is what it makes the most sense for them to do in terms of their seafood choices. But the recommendation is that they should eat seafood. Pregnant women, lactating women, all of us should be consuming more seafood. So the very powerful framework that I think we need to apply is social marketing that has been used very successfully in different public health arenas. I am very familiar with the breastfeeding promotion area. And social marketing is a framework that is much more than media campaigns. It includes media campaigns, but it's really selling health. It's the whole concept of having a product. We have seafood with its wonderful benefits. We have the information to make it work, to place it through the right channel so that the target populations can have access to it at the right price, preparing it the right way. So I think that is an approach that we're really going to need to get more involved with. I think there is a lot of room for behavioral health communications, benefit risk communications. And if I was starting my career, I would love to get engaged in something like this, because we know for different ethnic racial groups, we may need different approaches, and we need to do a lot of research, to do our homework to be successful. The WIC program, I think, is very, very key for a number of reasons, including the fact that dietary habits get established very early on in life. They have access to a very high proportion of the low-income moms and young children that live in our country. What would it take for this to work out, a strategy like this? Well, we do need to provide the consumers with timely and accurate information. And this is where we need to use the best way we can all the wonderful information technology that is now available. I've been in a number of committees now where social media is the buzzword. I have to ask my sons about some terms that are used in those meetings. But definitely, you know, I think this is an issue that is not simple, because people need information for different seafood species. And the U.S., the government, and so on, needs to do a better job at monitoring contaminants in seafood. And the local seafood advisories need to be made accessible to different groups, oftentimes in different languages, for people to really understand which areas are safe to obtain their seafood from, and so on. And if this was not complex enough, we also have the enormous environmental issues that we have to face, because we know that if tomorrow everybody followed our guidelines, we would probably wipe out a lot of the fish species that are now in the ocean, and then there's not going to be variety anymore for anyone. So we now know that farmed seafood contributes to over half of the fish intake in the world. It is incredibly important that we monitor, and for those of you who are experts in that area, that develop more environmentally friendly, more sustainable systems, and that we also pay a lot of attention to the enormous loss of biodiversity that has already happened in salmon because of the very, very high degree of farming that has happened throughout the years. Thank you very much.